Welcome to the AI Podcast. I'm Max Mitchell, podcast editor here at Engelsberg Ideas. Steve Shapiro, who died in 2022, was one of the most important American photographers of the 20th century. He documented, like no one else, his country's messy efforts to live up to its founding ideals through the civil rights movement and captured the finest moments in its cultural outpouring from the 60s onwards. From the Selma and Washington marches to the jazz clubs of Manhattan, and from migrant worker camps in Arkansas to the sets of Hollywood films, Shapiro truly seemed to be everywhere. So today, it's a real thrill to be talking to Maura Smith, who is not only Steve's wife, but a very talented filmmaker in her own right, and the director of a new documentary about his life. It's called Steve Shapiro, Being Everywhere. Maura, thank you for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, Steve photographed everyone. You know, Martin Luther King, Muhammad Ali, Rosa Parks, Bobby Kennedy, Jackie Kennedy, Samuel Beckett, René Magritte, David Bowie, Barbara Streisand, Jimmy Baldwin, Mel Brooks, Marlon Brando, Marcello Mastroianni, Andy Warhol, Art Blakey, Bill Evans. How did he manage this? How did he manage to be everywhere?
Steve was workaholic. He was, you know, Steve was a workaholic. His career meant everything to him. And he married the right girl because I didn't care. I didn't mind that he would be going off and doing that. And anytime he had a job, our deal was that if he went more than 5 days, we go together. Other than that, you know, we stuck to that pretty good. That we, if it was 5 day or more, we'd go together. So Steve wanted to be a novelist. He graduated, he started school at Amherst College in Massachusetts. It really wasn't a good fit for him. He was a little bit more free-spirited. So he went to Bard College, which would have been considered a hippie school and kind of is. It's a good school, but it's kind of a hippie school.
And, I believe that's where Donald Fagen and Walter Becker went of Steely Dan.
Oh, and Chevy Chase. Chevy was in the Steely Dan band. He was the drummer. Did you know that? Yeah, he was. Chevy's a good, his daughter is my goddaughter. So Chevy's a good buddy of ours. And yeah, he was in the Steely Dan. And Herb Ritz went to Bard. He has a lot of nice alumni. But anyway, so Steve went there, wanted to be a novelist. He was a literature major, which he really, he was a good reader. He was well-read. And he got a deal that he got to go off to Paris for about 3 months. And in Paris, he wrote his novel. And he came back to New York where he was born. And he realized, I've got 5 great pages and nothing else here. So he thought, that was his opinion. He thought, I better find another job. And that's when he kind of got interested in photography. His parents had given him a camera. So he had kind of, since about age 9, he had kind of been taking pictures around town. But his really first big opportunity was this minister at kind of a famous church in Manhattan, Riverside Church. This minister, I don't know how Steve met the minister, but anyway, he met him. And the minister said, you know, you should go to Arkansas and do a neat, interesting story about migrant workers. And, you know, so Steve did it. The minister, you know, gave him some connections, and it was that story. It's still, I don't know if you paid much attention to the migrant photos. They are really the best. They are so lovely. I blew one up to 40 by 60 in our home because it just is such a strong picture.
So that was one of Steve's key early moments where he made his mark as a photographer on the national scene. And it's amazing because at the start I mentioned all the famous people that he had taken photographs of, but so much of his work is really about the people who aren't famous. It's about the downtrodden and the different random people that he finds dotted here, there and everywhere. And he seems to capture the essence of strangers and make you care about someone you'll never meet and you'll never know. and you have no idea what they do in life and no reason to necessarily care about them. But the way he shapes his photographs, the way he manages to just catch people at this perfect moment, I don't know how. It's just such a skill.
Yeah, no, you're right. I have many things to say after you said that, but one I just going to add on right away. That migrant story ended up, one of the pictures became the cover of the New York Times magazine. They saw this, they saw his take, and they made it, cover. So that was a big deal for a young photographer to get a cover on the New York Times magazine. And then right away, another person, kind of through the Riverside Church minister, a doctor who was working with addicts, Steve connected with that doctor through that minister. And so Steve then did a whole story about addiction, which was very tender. I mean, there's a picture of these two addicts walking in the alley, kind of, and the little girl is looking up at her dad, kind of looking troubled. He really did. You're right. He really did get emotional moments from his pictures. Emotional, good emotions and bad emotions, you know.
Yeah, no, that seems to be a part of it, because he took a picture, famous picture of James Baldwin. All the captions I can see of that picture are James Baldwin with an orphaned child. It's in the documentary. There's the cross behind them, and it's just extremely poignant and heartbreaking. And he seemed to capture those moments. It wasn't just the glamorous and even the angry and the passionate. There was, you know, lots of tender moments that he wanted to capture. And he says in the documentary that he was taken with a photographer called Bresson, Henri Cartier-Bresson. And Bresson once said that to take a photograph is to align the head, the eye, and the heart. It's a way of life.
Yeah.
Yeah, could you tell us a little bit about Steve's influences and what he wanted his pictures to look like and who he really liked?
Yeah, you know, I never heard that quote. That is such a tender quote from Cartier-Bresson. Yeah, Steve, that was certainly, Cartier-Bresson was his hero. You know, he was French photographer, kind of famous for doing just people in ordinary lives. Another one he liked was W. Eugene Smith. Steve studied with him a little bit on how to print black and white, which Steve never really did much of his own printing. He never had time. He never would have had time to do the printing. And it was kind of fun, Max, about maybe 8 years ago, maybe 10, I don't know. We were in New York and Steve brought his Irving Penn book that he, treasured, and was a neat, it was a good book, first edition. And he brought it. I was doing something and he went to Irving Penn's studio and asked the secretary, would you consider asking Irving Penn to sign this for me? You know, and the secretary said, oh, you know, we'll see. Come back in an hour or two. You know, I'll see if he'll do it. So Steve went back in about 2 hours. And when Steve walked in, the secretary said, just wait 1 second for a minute. And Irving Penn came out and said, I have always admired your work so much. He was out of his mind. I would say for months, he was out of his mind that Irving Penn would appreciate his work. Yeah.
That's really sweet.
It was sweet.
So Steve is coming up in the early 60s as a young photographer. And he very quickly, after going to Arkansas, he quickly starts to document the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. Why did he feel so compelled to be there? Because there's obviously so many photographers who could be in much nicer, more glamorous places.
So Steve, unlike his wife, who reads 3 books every 10 years, Steve read a lot. And he read that article that James Baldwin had written in the New York Times, I mean, New Yorker magazine. And it was kind of the beginning of the Fire Next Time novel. And so it was that story that got engaged Stephen civil rights. So he contacted his, as in the film you hear, he contacted his picture editor, the picture editor Life, and said, could I do a story with this writer, James Baldwin? And that was really it. That was that admiration of James Baldwin is how Steve's whole civil rights thing happened. You know, if he hadn't read that article, I don't know if he ever would have gotten to Selma.
Well, in the documentary, there's a really moving part about Martin Luther King and Steve documenting him for a long time. And then Steve was also the first photographer to be at the Lorraine Motel after Dr. King was assassinated. Could you tell us a bit about that? Because that's a wonderful part in the documentary.
You know, I get worried. I've seen the documentary a lot now, as you can imagine. And I always get worried. You know, I don't want your audience to not watch it, but I always get worried, is this getting boring? And then, but I know the moment we hit the Martin Luther King motel room, I've got you. You know, I know from then on, you're not going to get bored. You know, yeah, so Steve was, as he says in the documentary, Steve got a call from Life magazine. He was eating dinner in New York. And I got a call saying, hey, Martin Luther King's been shot. Can you get to Memphis quickly? Because that's where he was for a protest. And so Steve got there. And those color pictures, Max, that you see, I found those pictures about 6 years ago, like 2 years before Steve died. Steve always did black and white, he didn't do much color. And I found these slides. I go, hun, these are so emotional in color. This is amazing. You got to put this in a show. And I didn't know it was going to be it. That first time they really came out was in the film. But yeah, so Steve got there and he got to the airport in the morning, found out that Martin Luther King was already dead. And then he went to the motel where they said that the assassin had been. And you know, it's, you really feel the presence of that evil. You really feel the presence in those pictures, you really do. And then he went over to the Lorraine Motel, and you know, the no one was around. That's the other thing. It's not like today. It was weird. You know, they'd probably gone to the hospital, probably, you know, the photographers had gone to interviews at the hospital, but nobody was there. Yeah. And so he just knocked on the door, and Martin Luther King's aide was still in the room, and Steve went and took some pictures, and they're really emotional to, you know, to just capture somebody's life that didn't know they were losing their life in 3 minutes. You know, that's eerie and tender.
No, it is an eerie part of the film because the juxtaposition between the photographs from the room where the assassin was, it's haunting. It really is haunting. And you don't need to be a religious person to feel the presence of something heinous, a really awful spirit in that. And then you cross you the documentary is great because you feel that you're crossing the road with Steve minute by minute as it's happening, and the picture that became so famous of Martin Luther King's bag with the two books poking out, it's really just an amazing story to be a witness to that moment of history and that tumultuous period of American history. It's incredible.
In my hallway, I should, if this computer could move, and you know, if it was easier in the hallway, the two pictures I have, 40 by 60 in our front hallway, are the Martin Luther King motel room and the migrant workers, both 40 by 60s, you know, because those are like two really significant photos.
And another great bit of the documentary, not that I'm ruining it at all for anyone who's going to go and watch it, but the way Steve talks about Martin Luther King, and he says, I realized years later when I looked back at all the pictures I took of him, that he seemed to be looking out the corner of his eye in almost every picture because of the death threats. And it really struck me. I never thought of it before, but there's never a picture where he isn't double taking the crowd and look, you know, really ever vigilant, knowing that if someone wanted to, there would be nothing he could do to stop them. It really hit me. It's not being from America, being from Britain, made me think that that violence is still a part of American politics. But that's a really powerful part of the documentary. Then it kind of moves on as Steve's career moves on. And how did he move from being a kind of photojournalist into Hollywood, I suppose you would call it?
That kind of was accidental. Steve was a freelance photographer for Life magazine, Look, all the Time, Ladies Home Journal, you know, all the different magazines. He lived in New York, so it was easy for him to get assignments from a lot of different magazines. Sports Illustrated, he did the Muhammad Ali for Sports Illustrated. But this guy, who's a nice guy, actually used his son one time as an editor, Bob Willoughby. Bob Willoughby was scheduled to do Barbra Streisand's first film, Funny Girl. And something, there was some falling out or something, or maybe Bob suddenly wasn't available, but Steve got the job. And they kind of got his foot in the door to be working on movies. Steve was never a still photographer. You know, a still photographer has to be on the set every day and document every single scene. Steve would be sent a script by the studios or the production company, and they would say, read the script and tell us what scenes do you want to film. And he would just go in and film the scenes he thought were going to be the big scenes or the scenes that would be more emotional. So it was really that accident of Bob Willoughby not being available to do Streisand's first film. And so that kind of just kept building. But then the real big thing was when Life magazine folded and, you know, and Look too, almost at the same time, Steve, you know, thought, oh gosh, this is not going to work out for me. You know, he moved to Los Angeles, you know, and really that became his career, was really working on film sets and doing, it's really what he would be doing is doing publicity for the movies. And then they would hire him because he still had good connections with, you know, magazines still back in New York.
Yeah, and so he took the amazing pictures of The Godfather,
yeah,
and Brando. What did he say about Brando? Because he was such an elusive character.
You know, Steve worked with him a couple of times, you know, because he did Apocalypse Now. He said Brando was fun. You know, Brando was an easy guy. He, as it says in the documentary on Godfather, it was a fun set. They were all goofing off. They were doing practical, you know, practical jokes with each other. It was a lively, fun group. You know, even though it looked like it might be a little heavy, it wasn't at all. Yeah.
Yes, because it's such a serious movie. The second Godfather obviously gets a little bit brighter in a sense that you're taken to Florida and Cuba, and not that it's an easier watch in a way, but it is brighter. But that's really funny that they were having a lot of fun filming the first one. Yeah. It doesn't seem like it.
You know, you don't think of Brando as being a fun guy. You know, just don't think about that. Yeah, no, he was.
And Apocalypse Now as well. What did he say about working on that? Because that must have been chaos.
Oh, it was. It was. You know, he got there and Martin Sheen had the heart attack, you know. So, and then there was a hurricane. You know, it was kind of like a disastrous film experience. But you know the story. But do you mind if I tell it?
Please do. Please do.
Coppola asked Steve that if Dennis Hopper didn't show up, because Dennis Hopper wasn't showing up. And Dennis Hopper played the photographer in the film. So Coppola said, you know, Steve, if he doesn't come, will you play it? And Steve goes, you know, if I had played that character, no one would have seen the film. He knew that acting was not his strength. Yeah.
Could have been a different career totally after that. Star of the show.
It could have been the end of all careers, maybe.
And he worked on Taxi Driver as well, and the photos from that are beautiful, particularly the one in the taxi of Scorsese in the back and De Niro in the front. It's an amazing composition.
Yeah, that's my favorite too. Yeah.
But why did Steve work so much in black and white? You know, he had that preference really his whole career when he could easily have switched to color.
I think it's the Cartier-Bresson, you know, and it's Eugene Smith. It was his heroes were black and white guys. So I think he just, you know, he always, you saw that picture. I'm sure you saw a picture that he has a bunch of cameras around his neck. You know, it's a great photo. He has like 12 or maybe let's say 7 cameras around his neck. And 2 of those cameras would have hit color. You know, we have... I have the numbers somewhere. We have 780,000 black and white negatives that we know are in the archives. There was no way, Max, that I could count how many color slides we have. It would be impossible. It would be absolutely impossible. So we have plenty of color. But it just was black and white was, you know, he wanted to be like Cartier-Bresson.
So how did you decide what should go in the documentary if you're dealing with hundreds of thousands of photographs? How did you, as the filmmaker, organize this long and storied career? Where did you start?
Well, it was pretty easy. It really was. Anyway, it was easy because Steve, I had gone to many of Steve's talks. Steve would, you know, like for The Fire Next Time, he would have book signings at different bookstores. Like one of my favorite moments was we were in this really big, crowded, nice book signing in LA. And Steve gave a talk for The Fire Next Time. And this gentleman comes up to me after the talk. And he goes, oh, you know what I like best about, what I found most interesting about your husband's talk? And I'm like being a fakey wife. And I go, oh, no, what? And he goes, that you listened. He's like, what have I been, you know, like scrolling on my phone or daydreaming or taking notes? But I always did listen to Steve's talks. But I knew his talk. I knew, you know, to direct the film, Max, I don't want to minimize what I did, but I'd go, honey, you want to go sit over there and talk about Martin Luther King? How about there and talk about James Baldwin? You know, it was pretty easy. And I knew that I knew the really good pictures that Steve liked for all of those topics. The only topic that was a problem, I'm sure you could guess, movies. He worked on over 400 movies. How do I pick which movie? I mean, I picked the top ones, but after Godfather and Taxi Driver and Chinatown, you know, I'm like, oh my gosh, I mean, 400 movies they had to pick from. And the other problem was what celebrity to put in. You know, there were celebrities in there that I still feel guilty I didn't put in. You know, Steve did the Jane Fonda workout book, which was very popular in the 80s. And I didn't put that in.
So there's an amazing book of Steve's coming out soon about jazz. And I managed to get my hands on a copy of it. And it's got the most fabulous pictures from the Apollo, Riverside Sessions, Village Vanguard. If anyone is into jazz, this is the most fabulous book. And so how did that come about? Because how did this remain in the vaults for so long?
I don't remember if I said it while we were on... Anyway, I'm not sure when I said it, but for years, for 35 years maybe, I said to Steve, you should do a music book. You should do a music book. And he always would just say, "More, I'm not a music photographer." And then after he passed away, my son and I like pulled out all this jazz stuff, and there was probably 20,000 negatives. And we, this time we brought it down to 3,000. Then we got it down to 1,000. But it took probably about 6 months to reduce it, you know. Yeah, I really like it. You know what I like about it is it's predominantly not performance. It's backstage. It's the guys hanging out.
It is. It's between recordings in the studio. It's the guys chatting, having a smoke, Aye, Sonny Rollins lifting weights at the Apollo in his tuxedo. It's really brilliant.
Yeah, my favorite picture is Sonny Stitts leaning down and kissing this lady. You know, I love it. I love the charm of the guys.
And Sonny Rollins wrote the foreword for it, which is great, and he says that these pictures were very emotional for him. He writes, "They take me back to a time when everything was, you could say, copacetic. Elvin Jones is smiling, and I don't think I've ever seen a photo of Paul Chambers smiling, but there he is, smiling." So Steve must have been just a very relaxed person. He must never have got in the way. You to be a photographer in that sort of space, you have to be very happy not being the centre of attention. How did he see himself? Was he humble like that?
You know, couple of things. One is Steve was short. He's about 1 inch taller than me. I'm 5'3" and a half. He was 5'3 3/4", and he was exactly 1/4 inch taller than me. As soon as I started going out with Steve, I don't think I ever wore heels again, which was fine. You know, uncomfortable anyway, so it worked out. But you know, Steve just is not obtrusive. You know, everyone will tell you that Steve would just be around and he'd like take a picture and, you know, just it was not a show off bone in his body. You know, maybe he was proud of maybe his work, but he just wasn't a show off. He would just casually be around and take some pictures. And I think people feel comfortable.
Well, he was so much not a show off that he takes great pains in the documentary to take his sunglasses off and say, "Look, I swear I'm not trying to be cool here. I can't open one of my eyes because I've been photographing my whole life and I can't open one of my eyes anymore. I swear I'm not trying to be cool here."
You know how we discovered that? When the wonderful politician John Lewis, who Steve adored, you know, he was involved in the civil rights and was a politician in America his whole career. So when John Lewis died, Steve was called at like 3 in the morning by Time magazine and wanted to get a good negative of one of the John Lewis pictures. And so Steve was delirious that of all the people for all the years, the Time magazine cover was Steve's photo. And he was delirious, not because it was Time, but because he loved John Lewis so much. So it really meant a lot to him. So because of that, it was during the COVID time. And because of that, a lot of different, like Fox TV and a couple of different TV shows asked to interview Steve because he had done their cover and they knew that he knew John Lewis. And that's when we really noticed in those interviews that his eye was acting goofy. And that was, so that would have been 2020. And so this documentary was made June 2022 or 2021. Sorry. So we caught it.
Yeah. And so the documentary took five or so years to put it all together.
No, the documentary, all those interviews were done in 2 days.
Well, were they? Wow. Wow. So it was just the editing process and...
The editing really... Editing was really pretty easy because, you know, I knew the stories. I knew my only decision, and you will know this, my only decision was most stories about somebody are chronological, you know, born, did this, and dies. I knew I couldn't tell the story that way. So my decision was to make it emotional. You know, let's the fun stuff, happy, and then we'll get to the more serious stuff. So that was the only decision I had to make. And in terms of putting the documentary together, it didn't really take very long. I would say we shot it in 2 days. Unfortunately, what happened is I knew Steve was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And so probably about maybe 3 weeks after that, I got a film crew in and we filmed his stories. And Steve loved telling his stories. You know, he was delighted to tell his stories. And then I just had that footage. And then after Steve passed away, I started to put it together, but it was really easy to put together. And then anybody here who isn't independent filmmaker, they will know the problem. You make a lovely, beautiful film that means so much to you, is finding the distribution.
Right, okay. The perils of an independent filmmaker.
Getting someone to see it.
Yes. At the end of the documentary, I think you rightly left that the most profound part till the end is when Steve converts to Christianity. Yeah, near the end of his life, and it's really profound and moving. How much of a part did religion play in his life? And then how did this come about? How did this happen? What change did he undergo?
It's a good question. I've had people walk out of the film when that happens, that they are offended by it. And I would never offend anyone intentionally. Never. I really would never offend anyone intentionally. But
Why would they be offended by it?
I don't know. But I have had people walk out kind of huffy. But okay, so Steve and I'm Catholic. I go to Mass every day. I went to 7 o'clock Mass this morning. I just go to Mass every day so that I can start my day with my head kind of screwed in the right direction. Steve and I think I can almost say this, never talked about faith. We never talked about a religion. He was brought up Jewish. I was brought up Catholic. He didn't really practice his faith. He had a bar mitzvah. His parents didn't really practice their faith. They were very happy to be Jewish, but they didn't do much about practicing it, and yeah, we never talked about it because one, I think his mother said to me the first time I met her, she goes, "I hope you're not going to try and convert him." And I think that comment got to me that, like, he gets to do what he wants to do. I get to do what I want to do. So I just, maybe in 42 years, 43 years, maybe on Mother's Day or my birthday, maybe a total of 6 times, I would say, "Honey, will you come to, you know, it's for my birthday. Will you just come to church with me and then we'll go have breakfast." I really don't think it's more than 6 times, that throughout our marriage. But what happened was, as I said, Steve got diagnosed on June 22nd, 2021, with pancreatic cancer. And my son and I, our son and I, were in the hospital room when he got the diagnosis. At noon, he did something that anybody who's married would be bugged by. But he said, "I have something I want to talk about." And I go, "Okay, hon, what? Sad day." And he goes, "I don't want to talk about it now." "Oh, okay." "Okay, you've had a bad diagnosis. We'll let it go." So at 5 o'clock that day, he said, "Okay, I want to talk to the two of you about something." And I go, "Okay, hon, what?" And I thought, anyway, I didn't anticipate it. He said, "I want Father Flager to come and baptize me." And that's, I promise you, Max, that's the first moment in my entire marriage relationship with Steve, I had any inkling that that was something he would do.
I think Steve's photography is so important. It's such an important cultural document of America changing, and he caught an old America that doesn't exist. And his pictures from the migrant work camp, for example, in Arkansas, they could have been taken to me in the 20s or 30s. They do not look like they're from the same world as New York or London or Paris in the 1960s, for example. So he captured that difference between urban America and rural America. But the story about him arriving after MLK had been assassinated, and you say it, and you saying that no one was there, he caught a world that very quickly would pass within 5, 10 years. Say Martin Luther King had been assassinated 5 years later, or 10 years later. Can you imagine how different the day after at the motel would have been, with camera crews from all over the country? And so he really captured America at this turning point? And finally, I just want to ask you, you know, it's very hard for you to be objective about it, but you know, when you love someone and have experienced life with them, but why do you think Steve's photography captures people's imagination and makes them feel things, and why do you think it'll continue to do so?
It's a good question, Max. I wonder if it's because, I don't know, I wonder if it's because you feel, I could have taken that picture. You know, if I had been there, I could have taken that picture. I just, you know, maybe it's something like that, that it feels comfortable. It doesn't feel set up. It feels like in the moment kind of thing. And we all in the moment, you know, we all could, and Steve says, oh yeah, what Steve says at the end of the movie, go out there, take pictures, you know, take pictures about something that means something to you. You know, we need your pictures to change the world. And I think that's true. I think we need people to get those nice emotional moments in life and show the tenderness in life, you know, not show the, I don't know, the decisiveness, you know. I like that idea. You know, it really is a good idea. Let's go out there and take pictures and, you know, change the world with our images. That's what he says. Change the world with our images.
No, it's a beautiful sentiment for someone who is a master of their craft to not be gatekeeping in that way at all, to say, you know, everyone should get involved in this in some way. But on that lovely note, Maura, thank you for joining us today on the EI podcast. It's been fascinating talking to you.
Thank you, Max. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to the EI podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please sign up to our mailing list and download the Engelsberg Ideas app. Explore intelligent perspectives on history, culture, and geopolitics anytime, anywhere. And best of all, it's totally free. Until next time, thanks for listening.